I'm Idris Francis, and having voted yes in 1975, I suddenly woke up in 1992 at the time of Maastricht to realize what the EU really was. It wasn't a free trade area. It's a political takeover of the continent by people we have never elected and we can't remove. It is a wholly corrupt, dishonest, devious, totalitarian organization, the like of which we have fought against for hundreds of years. And I, for one, am not prepared to put up with it.
My uncle, whom I knew well until he died sadly young in 1960 at the age of 46, but I knew him from the early 50s when he used to come down to stay with us in Cardiganshire. Very brilliant character who, amongst other things, knew David Niven and Eric Mashevitz, the musician. David Niven told him that he should come back with him to Hollywood after the war because he'd do very well as a heavy. He went across on D-Day on a landing craft as a regimental sergeant major with a pistol in his hand to make sure that everybody got off the landing craft. Fortunately, didn't have to use it. But in terms of what actually happened at Nuremberg, what I wrote is all I know. As I said, my aunt lives with me now. She'll be 90 in March. And he told her that not long afterwards.
Right, so what exactly did they say?
Well, I can't give it absolutely verbatim. For sure, after all of these years.
And maybe you could also just explain what the circumstances were. I mean, how come your uncle was in that situation in the first place?
Well, he was a major in the Royal Artillery, and he was stationed in Hamburg. Shortly afterwards, he became involved in the British Forces network, the broadcasting thing, which is why he met a few well-known names, although David Niven was in his regiment. The precise circumstances under which he was sent, I don't know any more than I told you. Hello, somebody's just come in. Wynne's still upstairs.
Okay, and I mean, what exactly did these German generals say then?
Well, as I say, I don't know. I don't have any proof or evidence of what the verbatim words were. All that I know is what my aunt told me at least 20 years ago, which is what I repeated in the email. But there's no way, of course, that she or I can prove it. There's no record of it as such, other than my aunt's memory of what my uncle told her. The words, as I remember them and as my aunt told me some years ago now, was, "Yes, you have beaten us again for the second time, but next time we will win." Which could mean anything. Those words so far could mean anything, but the really significant part was, "But next time, it'll all happen so slowly, you won't realize that it's happening until it's all over." Which to me means that they knew of the German plan for what became the European Union. The third time, they would do it by stealth and by deceit instead of by force of arms.
So why is it that you link this directly then to the EU?
I once had started a course of scientific German, and I left after the first hour and never went back. I just couldn't stand that guttural language with its made-up, convoluted words. So I have no ability to read German, but other people who are on my circulation list, and perhaps yours do, and one of them, I forget which one, but I could look it up on a very recent email, Albert something, I think, translated some years ago a German plan from about 1942 or 1943, setting out how Germany would run Europe after they had won the war. It was written, of course, at a time when they still thought that they would win the war. And the parallels between that and the European Union are almost exact. But I have actually seen a photocopy this was 10 or 15 years ago, I self-bought a copy of that German planning document, which was produced at some meeting of the high command in about 1942. And it includes, for instance, not a single currency as such, because it says, apparently, we couldn't expect the British, for example, to give up their pound, but it would just be locked permanently in value against the German mark. And the division of the country, of Europe, into effectively what some people are now calling economic protectorates in relation to Ireland was much the same. And the whole ethos of the whole plan was clearly what the European Union now is. I graduated as an electronic engineer just over 50 years ago. So my abilities are primarily mathematical, business. When I was, I'd only worked for anybody else for 2.5 years before I set up my own company, and I sold out in 1994 to retire to become a full-time bloody nuisance.
Yeah.
To people who tell lies. Father was a solicitor, so I grew up with a better-than-average understanding of fundamental principles like habeas corpus, jury trial, the Constitution, why things are the way they are. And I remember when I said to my father when I was quite young, I don't understand this law, why is this law like this? And my father said, and looking back, I know that he was right, that our legal system had grown up over so many centuries and had been fine-tuned over the years, that up until then at least, before Blair came along, the vast majority of our laws did actually make a great deal of sense, and that the way to understand any law was to ask yourself why it would need to be like that, and then if you looked at it logically, you would discover that it was like that. For instance, as I've been saying to people recently in relation to Ireland's trouble, and I got a letter in the Telegraph about a month ago saying, as Ireland's only hope is to devalue to a level at which it is again competitive and write off its debts and start again, why is Britain spending £3 or 4 billion trying to prevent them doing so? And so can I ask you this question now? Have you ever wondered why we have a bankruptcy law that allows people to write off their debts?
You can end up with debt saturation where you just simply can't pay any debts.
That's
because
right. Somebody is so deep in the mire that they can never recover if they continue as they are. And in the name of humanity, you cannot any longer throw people into debtor's prison for the rest of their lives or condemn them for the rest of their lives to work to try to make money simply to pay somebody else, because the blunt truth is that they won't do it. The parallels, the law rightly recognized that at some point of indebtedness, you have to say enough is enough, write it all off. The people who have lost money or lent money knew when they lent it that they were taking a risk. The risk has now become real. They've lost it. They've got to recognize that and allow this poor bugger to climb out of the pit and start again, which is exactly the position that Ireland is in and Greece are in. So all this is entirely logical. I'll try and get back now to the point. In 1992, I came in and turned the TV on, and there happened to be a broadcast from Maastricht at the time of the treaty. And the Greek Social Affairs Commissioner, Mrs. Papandreou, faced the British TV cameras and said, and these are verbatim, no, you will not be allowed to work more than 48 hours a week, and you will not be and you will have to take a continuous break of 36 hours every week end. There have been far too many exceptions already. There will be no more. For 30 odd years, I'd worked 70 to 80 hours a week, and if I hadn't done, I'd have gone bust. And many of my friends in small companies were in the same position. And I realized with horror at that moment that the EU actually intended to make working hard a criminal offense. And I realized then that they were, by any rational definition, clinically insane.
There's all the difference in the world between what someone who's self-employed or running their own business like yourself is doing, and also obviously reaping rewards because of that, and a lowly employee. You know, it's a completely different...
If you're trying to justify a law on the 48-hour week, let's just clarify one or two particular points. If you said, we will bring in a law that will make it illegal to force people to work more than 48 hours a week, I'd have no problem with that. But if you bring in a law that says that even people who want to or need to may not work 48 hours a week, that is a very different matter indeed. I wrote to Ted Heath about it, and he assured me, because of the stupidity that he had in his head, that that was what was intended, but of course it never was. I argued with John Monks, because I've been to literally hundreds of fringe meetings since then, and I put the point to him like this. Take Bill and Fred, two brothers. One is naturally quick and competent and efficient, and he can make the money that he wants to make in 48 hours a week, and he's happy. His brother Fred is slow and lumbering and a bit thick and a bit envious of his brother. But to make the same amount of money so that he is happy, he wants to and is willing to work 58 or 60 or 70 hours a week. Why should Fred be forced to have a lower standard of living, even though he is prepared to work harder to achieve it? Is it not a matter of personal choice and personal circumstances? And similarly, although, as it happened, I was working for my own company, the same applies to somebody who works long hours for somebody else. If somebody's personal circumstances or ambition are such that they would prefer to work 70 or 80 hours a week for 30 years and then retire early and enjoy the fruits of it, but somebody else would prefer to work, as my sister did, 38 hours a week for 50 years in the civil service with long holidays, what the hell business of the state is it to tell the person who wants to work hard that he may not do so?
Well, I think you might have missed the point on that one, Idris, in that simply this is there being put there down there by the EU. I would personally say it's actually something positive about it, that it's there to protect the sort of unscrupulous...
No, it isn't. It isn't, I'm sorry, what you were
unscrupulous
saying...
Unscrupulous employers...
Let me give you an example of how it doesn't.
I mean, what about the cockle-picker type employers, people that employ illegal immigrants and that
sort
of thing?
I do not dispute for one minute that it is right and proper to have a law to prohibit people being forced to work the hours they don't want to work. What I'm saying is that people who do want to work longer hours and are prepared and happy to do so should be allowed to do so. It was because of that moment that I started to look more closely at the EU. And I have spent literally thousands of hours and thousands of pounds and been to hundreds of political meetings and spoken at nearly every one of them, finding out everything there is to know about the EU and its works. So I know what it is. It is totalitarian, it is evil, it is not just undemocratic, it is anti-democratic. Its entire ethos is, the same as it used to be in Russia, that the men in the office blocks at the in Brussels or in Russia can determine how the world should work in every minute detail and issue rules and laws that will tell everybody else in their country how to work, what to do, what hours to work, and that, in effect, that the official knows best, the people know nothing, and it is the only task of the people is to do as they're told. Well, I don't live my life like that. My reaction to being told what to do is to say, bugger off, you're not going to tell me what to do.
How would you explain to the layman what is that's wrong with the way the EU functions? And of course, because we do have democratic elections for MEPs, don't we?
please?
Well, no, but anyway.
Well, there we are then. How democratic is that? How much power have the MEPs got? None. Do you know how many laws the MEPs themselves can instigate? None. The only power to put forward laws belongs to, I forget which particular body it is, maybe it's a council of this or a committee of the commissioners. Who elected the commission?
Nobody.
No. Chris Patton was appointed by whom? By Major? Leon Britton was appointed by Maggie to get him out of the country because he was such a pain in the ass. Neil Kinnock was appointed to the commission by Tony Blair because he had failed as a prospective prime minister. And he now has an income tax on which he pays... He has a huge pension on which he pays 11% interest income tax, which I pointed out to him forcibly at a meeting. There is nothing whatever democratic about the European Union. The European Parliament is a facade of democracy. I have many UKIP and a few Conservative MEPs who are personal friends of mine, and they all say the same. It is, the people who are there refer to it as the bubble. It is a bubble of extravagance, of high living at taxpayers' expense, with no democratic provenance whatever. It is a shambles, it is a fraud, it is the very antithesis of democracy. I'm a Democrat. I believe in one man, one vote, by which politicians who control policy and the country are elected by the voters and can be removed by the voters. Would you like to tell me how you can remove any MEP? You only have to go and look at the fundamental principles of democracy which started in this country, to an extent may have started in Greece or Rome 2,000 years ago, but in modern terms started in this country in the last 300 years, to see that the EU is not any form of democracy. It is an organization run by greedy, grasping, power-mad, ego-driven, terminally corrupt and terminally incompetent people who are unelected by the population at large, appoint one another to whatever positions they like, and who, amongst other things, have tens of thousands of secret bank accounts around the world containing billions of euros, of which there is no official record.
Well, it's one thing saying that they're bumbling and corrupt, but it's another thing entirely to say that this is some kind of Nazi-type organisation.
I don't know. I know a lot of people in the anti-EU fight, and I have a circulation list of several hundred people. I doubt if there's any one of them who does not agree that the main driving force behind the European Union always was and remains Germany, with France, whose view apparently of Germany has always been that Germany is the cart horse of this operation, whilst the French is the jockey who rides on its back telling it what to do. But of course that's typical French ego. How many quotations would you like? Germany, Chancellor Kohl, as you probably know, had to stand down as Chancellor because he was forced to admit that he was regularly accepting thousands. Many say that the total figure was millions of euros in used banknotes in suitcases in dark car parks to fund his politics. He was in total control of his party because he had unlimited amounts of slush funds to retain his grip on power. And you know what he said when he admitted it and stood down? That it doesn't really matter because it was all in a good cause. The good cause being his control of the party and his determination to ram the European Union down the throats of people who didn't want it. As a friend of mine says, the words, "the ends justify the means," are amongst the most evil words in the whole English language, because they, if you believe them, if you accept them, it allows you to do anything, however dishonest, however devious, because you think that the objective that you are trying to achieve is a good one. And I've said, funny enough, I had a discussion with quite a lot of people relatively recently on email, and by and large, they agreed that in all probability, Adolf Hitler never saw himself as evil or perverted. He probably did, in his own head, think himself as a man who was doing what was necessary to achieve desirable goals of success and domination for Germany. And of course, there are some people, start talking about the Yorkshire Ripper and people like that. How can we understand what goes in the head of people who are mad? But when we fundamentally come down to it, what we have with the European Union is an entirely corrupt organization, which was incidentally set up to be corrupt. You presumably know the name Marta Andreasen.
What about to the current Conservative administration? Because you would have thought that maybe there would be quite a strong independence from the EU streak within the Conservative Party right now.
It's always been astonishing to me that how small that streak remains, or at least how few of them are actually prepared to put their heads above the parapet. I know I've known Bill Cash since the time of Maastricht, when I started to contact him to encourage him. He and a few others like Redwood, the fact remains that as far as anybody can tell, they are still a tiny minority. And although the recent new intake are supposedly much more Eurosceptic, there is still, a number of them have effectively said this to me. Yes, it's all very well being opposed to the EU, but the first thing we have to do is to get the Conservatives back into power. And we're now in the position that however many Eurosceptics there are, they're hardly likely to exercise their frustration to an extent that will bring the government down and let in Miliband and his idiots. So the difficulty with all of that, the fight against Euroscepticism, is that it is not a fight that you can fight on its own in isolation from the other problems. There's an interesting piece in the Sunday Telegraph yesterday. I forget who wrote it, maybe one of the usual columnists, but he said, "Do you happen to be having a drink with Nigel Farage the other day?" And Nigel said that he expects UKIP to win the European election in 2014. And this chap said, maybe that's just Nigel just hyping things a bit. But since then, he has put that point to quite a lot of Conservative MPs, expecting them to laugh about it or deny it. But in fact, the universal reaction was one of gloom and the prospect that he might very well be right. I don't know whether you've seen the latest polls, but the last one I saw was about 58% British people want to leave the European Union, and about 25% want to stay. I picked up Nigel and Marta Andreasen from a railway station to take them to a Christmas dinner, a UKIP Christmas dinner in Kingston. Not last year, but the year before. And as we were walking to the car, I asked Martha one particular point. But as you know, the accounts have never been approved by the auditors ever since the auditing system was set up at 16 years. And any organization, commercial organization, that behaved like that would long ago have been closed down. But the European Union, of course, hasn't. It just carries on. So I said,
is it that an organization can be so corrupt with such huge amounts of money? How can it be that, as I've been told by MEPs, that there are large numbers of people working in Brussels for the Commission well over retirement age because they dare not leave for fear of what their successors will find? How can it be that right across the board they fiddle their expenses? They sign on in the morning and get on the plane for home, like Kinnock's wife did, and lots of others, and so on and so on. How can it be all so corrupt? And having put that to her, I asked the question, surely it is the case that it is like that because it was designed to be like that from the very beginning, to ensure that there would be enormous amounts of money, unlimited amounts of money, available to these people in slush funds to do what the hell they liked, and to ensure a ready supply of MEPs who, with their high salaries and fraudulent expenses, wouldn't want to rock the boat, and to ensure that the people who worked for them for the same reasons will be happy to keep this corrupt ship afloat. It must have been designed like that from the very beginning, wasn't it? And she looked at me in surprise, rather, and said, of course it was. There's never any question about it. The reason it is corrupt is that they want it to be corrupt. And the reason it hasn't been stopped is that they don't want to stop it. That is the nature of the organization that runs your life and mine now. And I don't know about you, but I've had enough of it. I've known about it for 18 years. And as I said to Chris Hoon, when he snootily said to a meeting of people, oh, the only reason you don't like the EU is that you don't know anything about it. I said, Mr. Hoon, I've studied the EU since 1992, and I've spent thousands of hours doing it. I can assure you, I know more about it than you do. And what's more, the more I know, the worse it gets. And that really is true. Every day brings new horrors of incompetence and determination to squeeze this country and destroy it for the advantage of the greater Germany and the greater France. When that idiot French Prime Minister was here a few days ago trying to make out how Anglophile he was, and he's married to a Welsh woman, as it happens, he also said that it is absolutely essential to have greater integration to save the euro, that we can't escape, that we have no alternative. Well, I got news for whatever his name is. He can go and take a running bloody jump, because I haven't lived in this country for 71 years to be told what to do by Frenchmen I have never elected and never would have the chance to elect, nor have I lived in this country to see it taken over by thieves and crooks and liars and cheats and charlatans, and that's what they are, every man bloody jack of them.
Well, what about, we've still got a very strong, in fact, most people would argue the most important factor in all this is that actually Britain is still run from Westminster, and there's a certain amount of paranoia of people saying it's run from Brussels.
I asked the head of the Health and Safety Agency at a fringe meeting, what proportion of the laws that you enforce come from Brussels? And he thought for a while, and he said about 80%. The vast majority of the laws that EU introduces, which is about, opinions differ, 60, 70, 80%, go through Parliament on the nod. And Parliament does not have the power to change one single dot or comma in any of it. They can stand on their hind legs and argue about it. They can talk about it and discuss it, but change it, they cannot do. It is not allowed. About 18 months ago, the then new head of the European Parliament, Gert Pottinger, something like that, called into his office Daniel Hannan, MEP, and Roger Helmer, MEP, both Conservatives, and both of whom I know quite well from meetings and emails, and fined them £1,000 each for showing dissent in the European Parliament, saying dissent is not allowed. Well, as it happened, 2 weeks later, he was in London on his circular tour, having been appointed head, and he was speaking at the LSE, although it was a public meeting, and I went along, as did Mark Glendinning of the Democracy Movement. And from the third row, I heard him talk about meeting the Queen and meeting Gordon Brown and David Cameron and what a wonderful country this was and democracy and all of that. And I interrupted him, to the astonishment of an audience that was largely Europhile, and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Pottinger, you don't understand democracy. Only last week you called into your office two MEPs and told them that I fined them £1,000 each, saying that dissent is not allowed." He tried to deny it, and I then named the MEPs and said, I know them both. And I said, "Your view of democracy is rather strange. In this country, we pay Her Majesty's loyal opposition precisely to show dissent. That is what they do. They stand on their hind legs and dissent. But in your version of the world, dissent is not allowed. Only the people who are in charge have any right to say anything or to formulate policy, and we are not allowed to disagree. If you call that democracy, when it's a very funny democracy, and I don't agree with it." This, incidentally, is not verbatim, but is substantially what I said, and was later reported in private eye. "Do you want to live in a country where politicians are told that they may not disagree? Doesn't that give you a chill feeling in your stomach? Doesn't it remind you of 1984?
Okay, finally then, what can we do about all this?
Get out. Even the people who, for years, people like Ruth Lee, whom I know, can't remember the other people who were directly involved, who for the last 10 years have effectively said this: "Oh, no, no, we mustn't talk about leaving." Or Tebbit is another one, of course. "We mustn't talk about leaving. People aren't ready for that yet. We must just talk about fixing it." Even they now are saying publicly and in print and in the Express recently that there is no possibility whatever of ever fixing the European Union from within. You might like this story too, because I said I've been to hundreds of meetings. Do you know what the hell's his name? The Russian dissident, Vladimir Bukovsky. He was speaking in the House of Commons in a meeting room, a public meeting organized by the Campaign for an Independent Britain. And at the end, we had questions, and I asked the first one, and I said, "Some people try to tell me that we shouldn't talk about leaving, that what we should do is to fight and fix the European Union from within. What do you think?" And this is actually on tape, a tape of the event. He laughed out loud and said, "You remind me of when I was a young Russian dissident, and in our small group, somebody suggested that we shouldn't fight it from outside the Communist Party. We should join the Communist Party and fight it from within." But an older man looked at us and said, "Don't be stupid. Fighting communism from within is like going to a brothel to fight venereal disease. You will catch the disease and die of it. The European Union is a disease. It can only be eradicated. It cannot be fixed." Take note of that final word. It wasn't me. It was Vladimir Bukovsky, who had lived through it. And he said that the parallels between the EU and Soviet Russia are exact, with only one exception. Even the KGB didn't have diplomatic immunity for whatever they did.